Attend AutoCon 2 in Denver, November 20th through 22nd, 2024. You'll hear presentations about network automation from hands-on engineers who built automation systems for their company and have the scars to prove it. Conference pricing is not high, but this is a boutique event with limited tickets. Go to networkautomation.forum/AutoCon2 to register today.
Welcome to Total Network Operations, the podcast dedicated to hardworking network operators like you who deliver all the packets between the data centers and us humble end users. Here on the TNOps podcast, we want to shine a bright light on best practices in NetOps so you can take away useful ideas and make informed decisions for your network. I'm your friendly neighborhood internet plumber, Scott Robon. Today, we're going to talk about data centers. The criticality of data centers looms large in NetOps and in the overall operation of the internet. It's grown from where the mainframe is to where all the servers are to the home of the cloud, because there is no cloud. There are just other people's computers for rent wrapped in nice orchestration and service delivery systems. Computing for AI is accelerating data center criticality. There's no slowdown in sight on that front. In my neck of the woods in Northern Virginia, we've seen data center growth manifest physically. More and more gray windowless buildings going up west of Dulles Airport over the past 25 years. And that story is playing out in many other places all over the world. Standardized network architectures, white box hardware, the increasing dominance of layer three designs all have significant implications and opportunities for data center NetOps. We'll have lots of opportunity on TNOps to talk about data center issues, and we'll get it started today with our guest, Mike Bouchong. Mike needs little introduction. He is a true industry leader across several different networking domains, as well as from a product and a people perspective. Mike has been spending lots of time on data center networking issues, and he brings many talents to the table, one of them being extremely effective storytelling. And I can say that his work here enabled me to do my job over the span of two decades. Mike, it's great to have you here. Thanks for coming on today. You've had an interesting path. Tell us more about yourself and how you found your way into your current focus on the data center networking space.
So first of all, I'm going to just come in here and listen to this intro you just did for me whenever I need like a little bit of a pick-me-up. So thank you for the gracious welcome.
Easy to say when it's true. So, yeah.
Wow. So as you mentioned, like I'm in the data center space. I actually have a goofy background, and I think it informs a lot of how I see things. I did research for Boeing on the jet engine design and some, you know, the winglets on the end of planes. Like that's, I actually did some work that started there. Spent like a year in databases as a tech writer, went into chip design as a tech writer, figured out how to use the tools, moved into training, and then moved into the networking space in 2001. I grew up with you at kind of a Juniper. You know, sort of that growth phase, kind of post-dot-com bubble, but kind of all the way through the, you know, sort of the rise of you know, Ethernet, especially in some of the WAN use cases. Like it was kind of a big, you know, fast movement. The thing that was important about Juniper though was that centrally they focused on you know, operations, and so I actually got into the operations space very, very early. Moved into product management, moved into strategy. I've done some M&A work. I've moved back into product, into marketing, into spent a lot of time in the field. So I've got kind of a pretty well-rounded background. I've done startups. I've done big companies. I've rebooted stuff. I've built stuff. And all of that kind of, I think, will come to bear in this conversation because it gives me a fairly global perspective. And it gives me I would say my views have changed. From like, let's say, theory to practice. And I think that plays a role a bit in the NetOps journey.
For sure. I actually relate to that very much in terms of having started my career out with a very top-down academic view and really kind of seeing what's happening in the trenches really matters. And that's been a huge motivation for me to get this podcast series started. So perfect. You've seen some huge tech shifts, you know, including automation and disaggregation. Automation had a huge impact on both of us, right? You know, Slacks and beyond at Juniper. You know, what trends have stuck with you as the most significant in terms of impact on operations over your career? And tell me about how your views may have shifted, just like you mentioned.
Well, so I think I started off thinking everything was about programmability, right? When SDN came in, actually, my team and I were among the first in the industry to start working in that space, like in a real way, not before the researchers, but like in terms of putting stuff on production equipment. You know, we were very, very early on. It wasn't called SDN back then. It was called network programmability. Right. And I fundamentally believed, right, give me an API, you know, give me a structured way of dealing with things. And like, that's going to change the world. And so I think the work we did, you know, you mentioned Slack's. Obviously, there's a lot of work around NetConf and Yang early on. I thought, you know, frankly, if you get that work right, you're going to see, you know, developers start to move into the operation space. In some ways, we were right. I think a lot of the cloud companies kind of operate at that level. But then as I kind of waited for, and I went from company to company that had sort of an operational thesis. And the more I went, I realized it just wasn't enough. And so my views have changed a bit. I don't know that there's going to be a uniform approach to operations, first of all. I think people will do things that are cloud-like. And two, I think the barrier to adoption is more than just like, what's the interface? What's the tool? And so what I've kind of come to realize now, and this is sort of the big epiphany for me, is that after, you know, having sunk millions of person hours into this endeavor, I mean, like as an industry, right? Millions.
Sure. Yep.
We have to then somehow grapple with the idea that, you know, we're probably as an industry, you know, 20% automated. And so at some point you look at that and you're like, we have fundamentally failed at doing like large scale automation. And it's painful to say that, but then it forces you at least to have an opinion or develop an opinion about why is it we've failed. And I think what I've realized now, and maybe it's because I'm older, I don't know that I'm much wiser, but I think the role of people, I don't think it's just give them a tool and they will, you know, or build it and they will come. You know, this isn't like our field of dreams moment. This is, I think people actually matter. I think there's a wholesale shift in the workforce that's happening right now. And I think that like that's going to change everything for a lot of folks. And to me, I think when I look at companies that are sort of grappling with their automation, you know, ambitions, I think the people side, the psychology, I just think it's underappreciated. And I feel like looking back in my career, I was pretty naive to just think it was all about tools and tech.
I totally agree with you. And I think I made this conscious shift maybe 10, 12 years ago, where I used to follow the interesting technology, however I defined interesting at the time. And I realized you can learn the tech, you can teach it for the most part. And people matter, they matter a lot more. And how people work together, right? And the leader's responsibility for creating an environment for people to mesh, you know, even when they don't see things the same way. I'm a big fan of Moneyball. I'm not really a baseball guy. I know you've got some baseball history, but I love the movie and I love the concept of you don't have to clone people because you can't clone people, but you need the right set of skills on the team, however that manifests itself. So sorry, long tangent there.
He gets on base.
He gets on base. Why do we want him? He gets on base. And I love the flipping of the magnet onto the magnetized board. I don't know why I love that. But well, so on the culture piece, let me fast forward to one of the things I wanted to hit with you. You know, there's a lot of talk about DevOps and applying DevOps to network engineering and operations. And, you know, one size does not fit all. I'm not sure I'm quoting you, but I think I'm at least paraphrasing you. You know, DevOps is supposed to rely a lot on automation. You made the comment that maybe we're 20% automated in network automation. How do you think of the continuum between, you know, shops where DevOps makes a lot of sense to shops where it doesn't make a lot of sense? What are some points along that line for you?
I think there's probably a few big ones. You know, one is just a lot of people have the will to do something in the automation space and even in the DevOps space. The question is, do you have the skill to do it? I think access to workers is tough. I think the cloud titans, especially with the hiring boom over the last 2 years, have taken a lot of talent off the streets. I think that some of the payrolls and kind of what they're able to pay, given the role that the DevOps plays in their, you know, broader, you know, as a service or cloud offerings, I think they're able to do things that normal companies, even like large Fortune 100 companies, can't do.
Right.
And what that does is that leaves sort of a a vacuum for everyone else. And so I think, you know, people need to be realistic about their ability to cultivate that. People will approach that gap in a couple of ways. Some people believe they're going to hire their way through that gap. And if you essentially have the resources to do that, you know, I think that's an okay approach. I will say that we do have to be champions for people. And if you think that you're going to abandon the operations team that got you to where you are so you can hire in a whole second team, like, I do think that we're, as leaders in this industry, we do have to kind of bring people along. And so I cringe a little bit when I see people who are like, yep, we'll just, you know, cull the herd, kill the first team, hire the second team. I don't think that's usually a very practical way to lead through stuff, you know, and I just think that we owe it as an industry to support people along the way. I'll leave the sort of the ethics of that out of it for today, but it's, right. I think it's a big point. And then I think we have to, so then on the skill side, if you've got the skill to do things, then the second thing you have to have is the ability to trust the tools. You know, we are fundamentally a CLI driven industry. The CLI is gone,
Mike. I've been told that it's been disappearing for, and I remember when I first heard that, it was a Jeremy Shulman conversation. And how do I say this nicely for a family show? I had to take a pause. It's like, no, I've been a CLI jockey for my whole career and you can't take this away from me. Sorry to interrupt.
If you're a CLI driven industry, not even just organization, you know, at some point having the confidence in the tools, especially when they've given kind of variable outputs, like it hasn't fully worked the way, you know, it was intended to work or the way that people thought it was going to work, I should say. I guess everything works as intended, but I think people don't have if you don't have the trust in the tools, then you're always, you know, working around the tools. I mean, we hear all the time. So, you know, Jeremy did a lot of good work in a couple of places, including, you know, the folks over at Apstra. You know, that whole idea of a single source of truth, I mean, that's great. But if you don't trust the single source of truth, then what you do is you work around it, which then sort of undercuts the whole premise of that. And so I think, I think it's more than, you know, does the tool work? I think it's got to have the support of the people and kind of the emotional buy-in, and then all of that. So kind of the changes in skills, the different postures towards, you know, tooling and things like single sources of truth, which we could extend to like Nautobot or Netbox. You know, the work that I think Jeremy Stretch and Jason Edelman have done has been kind of transformative in our industry. So I think, you know, there are also good luminaries to call out here. I just think that those tools, they have it's a different way of operating, but it's also a different way of thinking. And then I guess given that there's different tools and there's different sort of skill sets, I actually don't think we're going to end up with some approach to NetOps. I think what you're going to get is a class of folks where CI/CD pipelining is kind of in their wheelhouse. And I think you're going to get a set of tools where it's like, that's not necessarily what they do. Their operations don't approximate, you know, software development processes. And you're going to see more, I won't say classic network management tools because there's deficiencies there, but let's say a next generation of management tools that do different things. And so I no longer think of it as like there's an approach. I actually think there's fairly discrete populations, and that job one is to figure out which of those you're in. Because if you blindly chase whatever the next thing is and it turns out it's not a fit for your organization, I think you burn people, I think you burn time, and you can eventually, you know, essentially stall out your operations ambitions entirely.
I think one of the complementary concepts I've been mulling is what if we go back and look at some of the things that have fed into DevOps today? Just one particular example, looking at like W. Edwards Deming, right? Statistical process control in manufacturing. And like by education, I'm an industrial engineer. So I learned about Deming from quality control and forgot about him for 30 plus years. And what if we could take the concepts that go into something like DevOps and reapply them? You know, like these changes in small batches, check your work, see what makes sense. What does real collaboration look like in a network operations environment versus a software centric environment. You know, I hope to come up with some practical, useful things from conversations just like this to maybe give network operations shops some more options. You don't have to go full DevOps to modernize your network operation. That's kind of an assumption I'm operating under here.
I think I think the idea of, you know, small batches of changes. I mean, if there are things to learn from the cloud companies, you know, they're not afraid of change, and so they'll make changes, and they roll forward. They don't roll back, which I think is another sort of big mindset shift, right? When things go wrong, you know, they sort of play through it. When things go wrong in most environments, they, you know, cling to the life preserver. They hit the panic button and they move backwards. Those are pretty big mindset shifts, and it changes the tooling that has to then support that. The idea of putting things into small batches and then sort of working through that, you know, iteratively or incrementally, I think what it does is it takes, you know, pretty massive problems and it makes them relatively small. The other thing it does is that you avoid, in that case, the changes becoming, you know, too big to, we hear like too big to fail, like in the banks and stuff, and
right.
In IT, it's like it's too big to succeed. And so at that point, like, I think the idea of breaking things into, you know, smaller incremental chunks, it simplifies things like, you know, multi-dependency management. I think it simplifies things like qualification and testing. It gives you a better understanding of the blast radius. You know, yep. The blast radius for a change can't be like the entire data center, all users, all applications. And so you got to break things down. And I like your comment there, because I think it in some ways it flies in the face of some of the things we're trying to do in other technology areas. If you think about, like, you know, management, we hear a lot about multi-cloud, multi-domain, you know, where we're taking, you know, what would have been small administrative domains and we're extending those over like these large multi-sites. So the whole thing is like one giant, you know, entity. And I think it's, look, we were in the, I won't mention too many products, but we were at a company that built a one massive failure domain in the data center.
Right.
And like, it's awesome when you think about optimization, you know, maybe not so great when something went wrong and like everything was down. I think we got to be somewhat mindful. And so you put those two things in contrast, that the desire to do everything at once and sort of the need to kind of break it into smaller atomic changes. I think people should be thoughtful about that as well, because it's a different approach.
Yep. No, I agree. Let me shift to a really great piece on LinkedIn that you wrote, I think April 2024, where you talk about the shift to operations for data center networks. And, you know, that bumped you up in my priority queue. When I saw that, I was like, I need to get Mike. And that's what turned me into a pest with your exec admin to get you on sooner rather than later. She was very accommodating with your calendar. Please thank her for me for that. And so were you. I know you've been a bit of a globetrotter these days. But you say the center of data center universe has shifted from architecture to operations. What are the biggest drivers for this in your view? What's pulling us away from, you know, that product engineering to the operation side is much more important?
A quick interruption to tell you about AutoCon 2, the third in the AutoCon conference series about network automation. Only don't think of AutoCon as a typical conference. Instead, AutoCon is a gathering of the networking industry to work towards a standardized approach to network automation. And this is a hard problem. Equipment vendors have a vested interest in selling you their automation tools, but let me guess, you're a multi-vendor shop. There are so many open source tools you could bring into your automation stack that it can be overwhelming. And if you want to integrate with products like ServiceNow, that is an added complexity. If you've tried moving from simple Python scripts to a robust automation system the business can rely on, you know what I'm getting at. And this is why the Network Automation Forum exists, why the AutoCon conference series exists, and why you should attend AutoCon 2 in real time in Denver, November 20th through 22nd, 2024. Hear the talks, interact with the speakers, talk to other attendees in the hallway track, meet the people making automation tools, talk to vendor experts who live and breathe this stuff. You're going to leave with solid ideas about how to approach network automation for your company, ideas that will impact the business that you support in a very positive way. Register at networkautomation.forum/autocon2. And I don't mean to sound dramatic, but don't wait, because this event is almost certainly going to sell out, and the venue only holds so many humans, there really is a ticket cap. Again, that's networkautomation.forum/autocon2, and I hope to see you in Denver. And now, back to the podcast.
In the data center, I think we've largely agreed upon what a data center fabric looks like. Broadcom's the de facto standard. You're likely building out an IP or an EVPN fabric. You know, there's a couple of different variants. You might have design choices around, you know, are you going to use a border leaf? Are you going to use like a data center gateway? Are you going to run something small, like a collapsed core, just a rack or two? Or are you going to run something that's big, sort of a pod design? But once you get through like the kind of a relatively small number of architectural derivatives, like a data center is a data center and a fabric is a fabric and a switch is a switch and even an interface is an interface. So when that's all true, then the problem to solve is not necessarily what's the architecture. We're all kind of building, you know, things that look roughly the same. You'll see similar topology diagrams from everyone. Then it's like, look, how do I manage all of that? You mentioned the cloud piece before, you know, like it's someone else's computer. It's really, it's someone else's operations. And that's what you're paying for.
Yep.
And so it's become pretty obvious that the thing, that the axis of competition, the axis of difference making really is going to be in the operations space. It's what do you do? As we talk about that continuum, there's two other things that I probably should have added. One, network engineers, like, you know, I don't know about you, but like, we're getting older.
Yep.
We're going to age out. And when we age out, the bumper crop of network engineers that replace and sort of fill the industry, they're not going to be, you know, Cisco certified, you know, having gone through, you know, sort of the rote memorization of arcane syntax. They're more likely to have experience in AWS and Azure. And so if that's true, then the tools they're used to, even like things like the CLI, a lot of that stuff changes. The tool chains are more likely to include, you know, Prometheus, Grafana, Git, and some of the other tools are all going to be different. And so I think there's a wholesale change in the interface that people use for the network. When that happens, and when you see this like standardization of the architecture, then the only thing left to do is to move into the operations space. And frankly, we see it in another, even in things that we would probably consider, you know, maybe not quite as difficult or as complex technology. You know, tools have rolled through the server side, and we're sort of even now still kind of just scratching the surface of what those tools can do for networking. I think operations is the future. And here the interesting thing, and I'll close here, is if we all agree on the architecture, what's interesting about the operations space is we have like wildly different points of view on operations. So not only do I think it's where we have to focus, I also think there's like competing theses about what the right operational approach is. And I think there's going to be some winners and there's going to be some losers out of that. And the companies that get it wrong, I think they're going to struggle and they're going to have competitive disadvantage. That's true from a vendor perspective, but also from like an end user perspective. And the companies that get it right are going to create, you know, sort of a multi-year advantage that they can, you know, use to you know, move into dominant positions. We've seen that in some of the larger cloud companies. They figured out operations before other folks. Look at, you know, when the service providers tried to build their own cloud offerings, and then look at how they've competed with, you know, like Azure, with Google, with, you know, OCI. Those operational advantages will lead to kind of sustained edges. And then for the people, for the individuals that are listening, you know, on your looking at kind of what the future of NetOps is, It's going to create sustainable advantage in their careers. And so I think operations is where it's at. And I think you've settled on the right space. It's going to be hot for the next decade.
So what do you think about every cloud provider has develop their own way of doing things? That's not completely disparate across all the major cloud providers, but I very much relate to, you know, when I started to have to teach people Junos, I started as an instructor at Juniper. Everybody knew iOS, right? And you're doing the same kinds of things, but you have to do it differently. And SROS does it differently, and EOS does it differently. you know, I see some really interesting parallels, you know, raised up a couple orders of magnitude between the router and switch, you know, operating system conventions versus what I can do with different cloud providers. And I'll complicate that with the removal or the abstraction away of the hardware layer, right? At least when I was logging into a router, a switch, or firewall, I knew what hardware was running, you know, what certain processor limitations were and so forth. That's totally taken away from me from a cloud environment. I'm not stating that as a, you know, a definitive problem, but it's a difference for the operator.
So years ago, I was talking to folks at eBay, and I'll leave names out. But they actually came up and they said, look, I have a 3 a.m. problem. I was like, okay, what's your 3 a.m. problem? He's like, well, when things are similar but slightly different, then somebody who gets called in to fix something and they're groggy-eyed and you know, logging in or you know, driving in or whatever, and then they have to quickly diagnose and remediate something. When things are very, very similar but slightly different, that person has to be contextually aware, which is really, really hard. And so his comment was like, if they're different, be different. And if they're the same, be the same. But sort of this gray area in between is dangerous. And what he was arguing for was, you know, essentially the, you know, either, you know, do your own thing and just be clear about what it is and how it works, you know, or mimic entirely. And because the incremental advantages of whatever, you know, optimization you're making are sort of outpaced by the operational challenges for real people working in those environments. I think with the clouds, you know, the people will pursue two paths, right? I don't think that you're going to see, so you will see some companies will say, I'm going to go all in on one cloud, and what that'll give them is a consistent operating experience, which I think has a lot of merit. It comes at the, you lose economic leverage, so your sure. your negotiations become, you know, it's more expensive,
right?
I think a lot of people are going to end up in multi-cloud just because they've got different lines of business that move that way, and they're going to get there organically, not by some architectural grand design. And then there's going to be two things that happen, right? People are going to offer tools over the top and say that we're going to essentially abstract the cloud in the same way that you mentioned the abstraction of hardware. It's not that hard to say, well, I could abstract the cloud as well. You know, things like Terraform, you know, try to do some of that stuff. And then you're going to see other folks who are going to say, you know, what we're going to do is break the problem into, you know, smaller administrative domains. And so we won't have uniform operations over the whole thing. I'm not sure which one of those wins. Abstraction usually takes a lot longer. In my experience, it takes a lot longer because if there's still churn under the hood, like if the things that are being abstracted are still sort of divergent because they have different things that they're adding at different paces, if it's not standardized, abstraction can be really, really hard because then it ends up being a lowest common denominator problem. So if I had to guess, you know, I'd say that the companies that at least like get the, given where we are with operations generally, I would say like it's okay to have different administrative boundaries or administrative domains. Make sure you're really good within those, and that the practices, the tools might be different, but the practices should be similar. If you can get to there, then as the abstractions kind of rise, I think they become more, let's say, well vetted or let's say more widely adopted, I guess is probably the better way to think about it. Then I think there's probably a path to the abstraction piece. But the pain point you talk about just with the underlying hardware, like that's going to exist with the clouds as well. And so if we right. think we're just going to build up like this tall, like a, you know, this huge tech stack that's somehow going to abstract away all the things, I'm skeptical whether that's going to happen. And I do want to, along those lines, by the way, when you mentioned the CLI thing, I think the people who say the CLI is dead, like I think that's probably observably false. I think the CLI is still there. It's just used for a different set of tools or a different set of workflows. And so I think our industry's tendency to treat everything as like all or nothing has been one of the like, looking back on my history where I've been a bad actor, like it's just never that simple.
Agreed.
And so I think what it does is it you start to alienate people because you tell them it's going to be a certain way and they're like, you know what, there's no way I could do my job only with you know, doing it the way you're saying. And so then what you get is this kind of this freeze in the workforce and people stop. I know it's, it feels like it's kind of meandering. I don't know how to break that down to something that's like very specific for you, but yeah, I think multi-cloud is going to be hard. And I think that abstraction is going to be hard. I think what we need to do is take tangible incremental steps to move people forward. Because frankly, if we can't get people off of where they are now, it doesn't matter how good the vision is. Like, you're just never going to get people to move.
Well, I think there are interesting pieces to the puzzle that are emerging, like the multi-cloud networking solutions, right? I'm not here to endorse, you know, anybody over another, but there's a market, right? That says, I want to be able to have seamless connectivity between different cloud platforms, right? And so solutions are emerging to help that happen. None of them are perfect, right? But they will get better.
I like that space. So I like the idea of saying, you know, my individual cloud practices may vary by depending on the tools I use, but I do have a consistent connectivity problem between them. I like that. And I actually think what happens with, you know, so whether it's Aviatrix, Prosimo, Alkira, obviously Nefeli already got taken out by Cloudflare. Yep. I think that class of tools, like, I like what they're doing there. I like the idea of providing a global multi-domain view. I like the hooks of observability where you've got different domains, because if you can't see it, you can't automate it, right? So it's like, I like that approach. And I think what that does is it provides some connective tissue between individually managed entities, which I think actually is a decent incremental approach, because it says, let me standardize on the thing in between my clouds, and then I can handle the clouds as I need to. And that gives you like a solid base that you could then use and sort of, you know, stretch some of those workflows or practices. I think that's the kind of change where it's like, you know what, let's go solve a specific problem. You know, even if it doesn't solve, like, we're not going to boil the ocean. I think we're going to solve a specific thing. I like that approach. You know, I don't know who's ultimately going to win, like, in those areas. And then how that ties into like the clouds, or how that ties into even like the vendor equipment. I think there's still a lot of opens, but you know what it is? It's progress. And I like anything that drives progress. I think it's good for the industry.
Same. And it gives me hope that other specific problems can be solved too, right? This is a pretty tangible one, especially for folks coming from a network, you know, engineering and operations perspective. Yeah. Let me take you back to things that we've learned and views that have changed. And, you know, if we're confessing our sins here, you know, from a technical sales perspective, I know that I had a view in the past of operations never being able to approve a purchase or decide in an architecture, only being able to stop them. And so in the past, I would say, well, okay, all we have to do is overcome their objections. This shift to operations in the data center space, I think, makes operations teams much more important and should put good product managers and good sales folk on notice that you really need to pay more attention to the operations space. If people who are only listening can't see you shake your head and roll your eyes, but so why don't you verbalize that? How did you react to what I just said? And how would you advise end customers to interact and make sure that, you know, their vendors are actually delivering what they need?
I think operations has historically been a bolt-on, and I think it needs to be like the lead. You're going to get the same thing out of the architectures. So the conversation should be like, what is this going to look like in deployment, in production? Like, that's where you start. People make, when you set up your RFP, right? The way our industry does RFPs is what I call the derivative RFP. You know, they had 816 lines on what they needed on the previous purchase, you know, 8 years ago. And right. So then they add the 817th line. Start over. Like, it's a different game. If you want operations to be better, like, you gotta step away from some of the legacy stuff. You can't carry all the baggage forward. Like, just free yourself. Two, the decisions that you make from there, you have to understand how that's going to impact your ability to make operations progress or not. You just have to. Like, there's decisions that will change what you're even what you have access to, and you got to be really thoughtful about, you know, where are you going, and does this make it easier or harder? I was talking to a customer in Europe actually just a couple, maybe like 2 months ago, and they have an incumbent supplier. I'll leave all this out because my goal is not to talk about specific vendors. And so I said, look, you've always used this incumbent supplier. They said, yes. I said, you have automation ambitions. They were very clear in what they were. I said, okay, let me ask you a question, right? If you have an incumbent supplier you're happy with, why are you not more automated? Like, you know, again, if you go with them again, are they going to get you where you want to go? And the answer was in the room. Everyone kind of laughed. They're like, of course they're not going to get us where we go. I'm like, well, then what are you doing? I don't pick whoever you want to pick. I even told them, I'm like, look, I'll be a consultant today. I apologize to my sales friends over there, but let's just drop some truth here. You know, if you're not going to get where you're going to go, then either drop the ambition or change the approach. I think you need to lead with the operation stuff. And then I will tell you this, like, companies are going to fail over. I mean, literally they're going to fail. I don't mean like in their technology pursuit. I mean, like, they will literally go under. I mentioned the workforce thing. Mm-hmm. So let's say that you believe fundamentally your workforce is aging out, and you believe fundamentally you're not going to compete with Amazon or Google or Meta for networking talent. If you believe those are true statements, and you have an operational approach that does not even allow you to hire the next crop of people in because it requires, you know, sort of the rote memorization of vendor specific syntax, how are you going to handle that? Like, yeah. when those people retire, like, what are you going to do? I ask my kid, like, I use this with the customers all the time. Like, so I have 12-year-old twin boys, and if they came to me today and said, Dad, we want to be software developers, we want to make a lot of money, like, what language should I guide them to? Right. And people would be like, you know, well, you know, Python, because there's lots of Python, or maybe like, you know, Go or Rust or R, you know. No, it's COBOL. If you want to make a ton of money, go learn COBOL, because that whole audience population is going to be gone if they're not, you know, mostly gone already. And there's just a ton of COBOL applications in mission critical systems. Like, you're going to make bank. The equivalent of that in networking is like, go hire a super expensive certified engineer, because that's the most expensive way to manage a network. Now, if that's a problem, and that's going to be a breaking problem at some point, then what are the operational choices you're making today that allow you to move to free yourselves from that? Like, I just, not only do I think operations needs to be have a seat at the table, I actually think they need to be, like, in many ways, 51% of the vote.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, it's, oh my gosh. So I know they can't, people can't see me roll my eyes, but like if I could change one thing, I could literally just one thing in our industry, I would give 51% of the vote to the operations teams, because, oh my God, the next decade is going to be decided, not even, it's not, I don't mean impacted. I mean, decided by the decisions that impact those, like the operations folks. And if you get that right, I think it's good for your company. I think it's good for your networking team. And frankly, I think it's good for you as an individual.
Yeah. There's always an underlay until we figure out how to fold space and time, which I'm not going to hold my breath for. There are always going to be circuits, and there are always going to be interfaces with cables plugged in that need attention, right? And I very much am not you called it out earlier. Our industry and its penchant for, it's either this or that. It's either A or B. It's like, no, it can be both A and B. You can have traditional networking skills and cloud networking skills. And oh, by the way, makes a lot of sense for you to have some of both, right? Whether you feel like you want to do it, whether you feel like I don't want to learn automation or not, right? It'll only be more helpful to you and to your 12-year-old twin sons, right? To maybe learn a little Rust and Go in addition to the COBOL courses you're going to have. You probably already have them going through right now, but
Yeah, it's I think the people who navigate this well are going to make a just they're going to really do well for themselves. I do think that amidst all of that, I guess the one thing we haven't really hit, I did comment that I think there people have wildly different views on operations, and mm-hmm. I do just want to say one thing about that. I think if fundamentally you believe that 20 years of futility in the NetOps or in automation space more generally, if you believe that futility is going to be solved, like the first 217 tools that came along didn't get us there, but the 218th tool is going to be amazing. Like I think it's a little bit of a delusional position to take. I think in many ways we're solving the wrong problems, and this kind of gets into if you were to look at the cloud companies, what they do is they solve the reliability problem, right? I mean, fundamentally, mm-hmm. what they say is like, let's, you know, we don't spend our time troubleshooting stuff. We make everything the same. You know, it's all about like driving standardization. That's how they solve it. I think you got to address the reliability challenge in all networks. And I do think that the class of operations tools to get that solve for reliability, as opposed to just solving for sort of workflow automation and speed, I think there's a big difference in approach on those, and the implications are quite a bit different. I would say people need to wrap their head around what that means. Like, why are networks frail? Why are there draconian change controls around data mm-hmm. center? Why do people, why are networks best at Christmas when you stop using them? I think you got to answer that question. And then I do think you got to, from there, it's like a different set of tools you would learn. You mentioned an interesting like industrial process example. I'll use one last example that's totally weird. So Dyson, right? Like the vacuums and, yep. and hair dryers now. Like, he was not like a classically trained, I don't know what you call a vacuumist, but
right.
A suck engineer. How's that?
You heard it here first.
But he took a different approach and said, you know what, like I'm gonna do something, I'm gonna pull something from other industries. And like the whole water screw was sort of what he arrived at, which gave him, you know, superior performance. It's actually an interesting story. People should look it up. Similarly, right? If we want to be good at reliability and networking, we might need to take a page from a different industry. And the most reliable industry in the world is aviation. And what do? Right? They have redundant everything. Okay. So Clove Fabrics provide redundant paths. That makes sense. You know, dual home your servers. They have checklists that they go through, right? So what if we, you know, have the equivalent of a pre-flight check? So things like, yep. digital twins start to play a role. You know, you can do dry runs of stuff. And then they have, you know, telemetry up the wazoo. You think of like what a cockpit looks like. You know, we obviously, things like gRPC, GNMI, you know, streaming telemetry from the devices, like that plays a role. The networking industry could learn a lot from the aviation industry. And I think tools, you know, that emulate those approaches. That's the thing where I think like I think that's interesting. And that's very different, by the way, of like, hey, where's my CI/CD pipeline?
Right.
Where's my, like, you know, what am I doing with, you know, with my underlying SCM? Like, I just think that there's different approaches here. And I will tell you, your listeners should be at least mindful that different approaches will lead to different outcomes.
I couldn't find a better place to wrap this up for now. We'll leave that as a tease for the next time you come on. And maybe we'll throw some more specific theses out there. And I just want to thank you specifically for saying Clo and not Cloth Fabric. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. You know, the OCD in me, just really, really thanks you. But not just for that, but for the conversation. Awesome to have you here today, Mike. For follow-up, where do you prefer folks reach out to you?
Twitter, I cannot bring myself to call it X. It's M Bouchong on Twitter. That's a dying cesspool. I'm actually more active on LinkedIn these days. And so you can find me if you just look up Mike Bouchong, find me there. And then I will say this, I respond to my DMs and messages. And if you need help just navigating stuff, like, a lot of this is not just technology, it's like, how do I manage my career? I love to pay it forward. I've been blessed by having a couple of really good mentors. So seriously, if you've got thoughts or you've got questions, reach out. I think we need to help each other as we go through this, because this is bigger than, you know, what's the next tool. This is really like, what's our industry going to look like for the next 10, 15, 20 years? So if you need help with that, seriously, reach out.
Well, I would second that. Mike is a great resource for things like this. And I know that from personal experience and from hearing him in a couple other forums recently talking about stuff like this. So Mike, thanks a ton. Great to have you. Thanks to the rest of you for tuning in today. TeenOps is a living research project, and I would love to hear your feedback, especially topics you'd like us to cover or people you'd like to hear. If you know someone or you are someone with important things to say about NetOps, let us know. These episodes provide a channel to promote best practices and big ideas from people like Mike and many others, and they force me to do lots of research. I love hearing the stories, stretching into different tech topics and areas, all with the goal of seeing what we could distill from this so it could be used by many others. To follow up, you can drop me a DM on LinkedIn or send us a follow-up at packetpushers.net/follow-up. Thanks very much, and see you next time on TeenOps.